great question. The way I see adoption moving forward with Web3, and I wrote extensively about it, and I still believe that those are the three pillars for widespread adoption, is education, which is already a gap in and of itself globally. So it is an edge. Regulatory integration. What I mean by that is that not everyone is going to be a DeGen and self-sovereign and will own their own self-custody wallet, but they will want to have access to it. And for that, regulators play a big part. They play a big part not only in enabling a level playing field, but they play a big part by benefiting of the data that is now public and accessible to them in real time, which is very different than the current way that they access banking information from the traditional systems that are all enclosed and siloed. And the third thing is user experience. If you're in Web3 right now,
Kaka Talks, stories of financial systems, crypto, and the Islamic economy.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another episode of Teka Talks. Today we have with us a special guest, Maurizio Magaldi. He's based in London. He is a seasoned digital transformation professional with over 20 years of experience in the financial services industry. So Maurizio's career spans renowned firms such as Citibank, or Citi rather, HSBC, IBM, and 11FS, where he has held various roles from chief data officer to business architect to board advisor for early stage startups. Maurizio holds an MBA in finance from FIA Business School, where his primary focus was on corporate finance and his final work covering aspects of the private equity and venture capital industry. He's also a pro bono mentor to various startups, thank you very much, offering guidance on implementing new business models based on enterprise blockchain and assisting with tech selection, member incentives, and scaling monetization strategies. So in addition to his professional endeavors, Maurizio is the host and producer of the Block Drops podcast, a weekly digest about blockchain for business delivered in his native Brazilian Portuguese. I believe there's some in English too. I was stalking your LinkedIn. Currently, Maurizio serves as the head of product for Midnight at IOG, leading a team of customer-centric advocates, designers, and developer relations to bring Midnight to market. So that was the official bio. Tell us the unofficial story.
Thank you, Shireen, for having me. It's such a pleasure to meet you and be on your show. That is quite, when we put some of the stuff in 20 plus years of career in writing, it sounds like a lot and it scares me a little bit, but it's just a lot of fun and a lot of learning. You know, right now I'm the head of product for Midnight. Midnight is a partner chain to Cardano. The goal of Midnight is to deliver data protection, decentralized applications that builders can come and build and integrate. So we're right now in a stage that we call a public devnet. We're open to developers. It's our developer sandbox, if you will. And we're having a lot of fun and we're learning a lot from the community so we can build a better product for all of them. So it's been quite an adventure. And this is my latest run in about 10 years in crypto. I first ran into Bitcoin back in 20, started reading a lot. I was still at HSBC at the time. And it felt in line with financial services because it's like, oh, digital form of money. And then soon after I learned about Ethereum, oh, programmable money. Okay. Oh, that's interesting. And then just went through the rabbit hole and got nerdy about all things blockchain. Got really lucky in my days at IBM. They needed someone to run blockchain services for Latin America. And I was probably one of the few in that organization that at the time had any exposure to that or any relationship to blockchain. Even internally in Latin America. So I got lucky and got offered that job. And then ever since then, I never stopped working with blockchain related things, be it on as my main gig or as an advisor to early stage startups, which, you know, it's just a learning ground of, you know, the utmost value. When I left IBM in 2019, I love podcasts and I love listening to podcasts and I learn a lot. I lived in São Paulo still back then. You spend a lot of time in the traffic in São Paulo. So podcasts are indeed a form of education that you can consume while you're driving. But I didn't find at the time, so this is like mid 2019, a podcast that would explain in layman's terms what was being built with the technology. Most of the shows at the time were like, oh, token go up, token go down, buy this token, sell that token. And I'm not a trader. I've never been a trader, even though I spent 20 plus years in financial services. But I like building things. And I felt that that was like a gap in my own knowledge that I, you know, if no one else is willing to fill up, then maybe I should. It helped a lot that I've been into heavy metal bands playing drums for 30 something years, and I know my way around an audio workstation. So it kind of made sense that I'm reading a lot. I can work with the audio. How hard is it to put together a podcast? Well, it turns out it's really hard, but you know, the age of innocence. And I ended up starting Block Drops recording inside my car Sunday morning in the garage of my building. That was the best capture I had. No microphones, no nothing. And I just picked the three things that I liked the most in terms of use cases during the week. And I just spoke about them, explaining them as if I was talking to someone who doesn't understand the depth of blockchain. So I've been doing this every single weekend, nonstop, ever, December, since December 19. And it's become my research platform. That's how I study. That's how I share the findings. That's how I discover gems in the industry. And yeah, and after that, it just became a door to meeting great people, having people over for block talks, interviews, and learning how they think, how they go about doing their businesses. And yeah, it's just a door opening for me. And at the end, I tell people that I will never be able to pay back to the show what the show has given me. So instead of paying back, I just pay it forward.
That's amazing, actually. It takes so much persistence and consistency to keep doing something on and on and on, you know, for many, many, many years, especially at the beginning when it's really hard because you don't know if anyone's listening, anybody cares. And so it's hard to keep going, but that's amazing what you've accomplished with Block Drops.
Yeah, it was great. It was because it was a selfish effort to me, you know, just to kind of fulfill the space in my mind. I've never accounted for metrics. It's not something that if it was for the numbers, I would probably just would leave it because, you know, it's not a huge hit. It's not like I have, you know, like millions of listeners. But the listeners that I do have, they are all high caliber. They reach out, they talk to me, they send messages, they point where I made mistakes in my digest, and we all learn together. And it's the beauty of doing things in the open and being able to actually field timely feedback is what keeps me going.
Fantastic. So I want to just pick up on what you started with, which is your introduction to, I want to say, you said digital money and then you said programmable money. Yeah. What was it about, let's say, Bitcoin and then subsequently Ethereum that causes you, first of all, to describe it as such? Because I want to say most of money is digital today, right? I mean, if you think about the supply of dollars, whatever it is, it's mostly digital. So why is Bitcoin different as digital money? And what about programmable money? That's an even more intriguing concept.
We'll be right back after the break.
Introducing TechAssure, the life insurance fund that is owned by the very people it insures. You share in the profits from insurance operations and take care of your family even after you're gone.
Intriguing concept.
So the reason why Bitcoin struck me as a new form of digital money, I think it's twofold. First is the resilience, right? It's an autonomous machine running on a multitude of computers that no one owns, but everybody owns. And that was a change in paradigm. If you grew up in the financial services industry, you don't understand money as a technology. that is not how you see money, right? It's an asset class, but it's not. Money is a technology. Even if it's not digital, it is still a technology. Then the second thing was, it was natively digital and prevented double spend. I agree with what you said. Money is digital inherently in most of the world, but you can double spend that money, right? It's centralized databases. I can program a rule that's obscure. Nobody knows. Lo and behold, my balance is 10 times more. Who knew, right? So the resilience attached to the prevention of the double spend was something that struck me, mostly because I come from a music background. I've had bands for over 30 years. And one of the phenomenons of the internet that really changed my perception about the value of things, especially music, was when Napster came about in the late 90s. And it was the same year where my band released our first album. And no single recording company would pick the album up, even though it was ready for distribution, because nobody knew what was going to happen in the industry, because music all of a sudden lost completely their value. No song was valuable enough because every song could be traded on the internet for free, or virtually for free. So I said, if music was recorded on such a thing, then I wouldn't have double spend. Then music could have retained its value. But that went away the moment I learned about programmable money, because I worked in banking. I'm like, oh, programmable money, great. And then obviously Bitcoin being resilient the way it is in preventing the double spend problem and potentially having trickle-down effects across other industries or asset classes was interesting. But me being banking and learning about, oh, I have smart contracts that I can tell, you know, what to do with forms of assets or forms of money, and I can immediately agree on a rule, and then whenever something triggers that rule, it does execute. That is very different from what you're used to see on the back-end systems of banking and in the public eye, which was more incredible. So that's what kept me going. And because that generation of blockchains was programmable, you could now start to foresee use cases that crossed industries. It could go from financial services to international trade to insurance in the same context with the same assets, and create integrations that until then were not possible. So from that point, I was more interested in learning about the benefits of blockchain and transforming industries rather than token go up or token go down. I always understood that tokens are part of the nature of blockchains because of the incentive architecture, but they were not important to me as much as the technology enablement was. And that's what kept me nerding out and learning for this long.
That's actually very cool. Let's unpack that a little bit and keep digging this hole. You say that money is technology. Okay, this is... If you were to tell, or if you would have told me this maybe 5 years ago, I would have been like, I don't know what you're talking about. Money is the stuff that is printed. And, you know, it's like the government issues this money, and the government is the thing that makes the money have value. And like, that's what money is. So what do you mean money is a technology? I don't get it. Explain.
So usually people attribute to money three basic characteristics. It's a store of value, meaning it preserves value over time. It's a means of exchange, meaning I can trade money for money or money for things, and it's observed and accepted across a group of people, a society, a jurisdiction, a country. And it also a unit of account, meaning it abstracts from having to know how many sheep I need to buy a boat, right? If I can convert sheep into an acceptable means of exchange, and I can do the same with the boat, then I have a unit of account that serves as a means of exchange. And because it relates to other types of assets, it also is a store of value. These are utilities. The reason why money has value is because it's recognized utility. Yes, is a most cases a concession from a sovereign state because it sets the standard, but it's valuable because these are useful features for organizing society around a common standard. You can say the same about computers. They are utilities. They have specific utility as much as money does. So yes, it's hard to abstract from thinking about money as something that has a backed reserve of some kind that is owned by a central authority that issues corresponding fractions of it that can be traded across a variety of entities and businesses. But if you boil down to the three basic characteristics of money, they are all utility. And by being a combination of utilities, we can attribute some form of technology functioning to money. So it's easier for me to think about that because then I abstract some of the more complicated geopolitical features that some forms of money can carry. And then it serves itself as part of solving more horizontal industrial problems.
Yeah. So you're saying to me, essentially, or you're saying to the audience that the value of money comes from its utility. And so
yeah, one form of value is money. Yeah, it's utility. Yep.
And so as we move ahead in the sort of history of humanity, the utility of the existing form of money, fiat currency, is becoming eroded because I guess the world has moved on. And would you say that this is why this new type of money, specifically the resilient non-double spend digital money plus programmable money, is now where the world is moving towards because those are the utilities that we need? So then would you say that something like gold is no longer as utilitarian as it was before and therefore loses its appeal as money?
Well, there's always trade-offs, right? Different technologies have different trade-offs, right? So if you want to explore the avenue of, is programmable money more valuable than fiat money because fiat money isn't programmable? There's probably a line of argument that says it is because you're now able to, in some shape or form, in counterpart to having recognizable assets on the same trading environment, get more liquidity out of those assets than you would otherwise with fiat, which is the whole RWA tokenization plus, you know, increased liquidity conversation. So the fact that we're adding features or adding utility to money with the power of blockchains or programmable blockchains makes, you know, that form of money increasingly more valuable, right? So I think there is a line of argument to pursue that maybe we're seeing the emergence of a fourth pillar for something to be considered valuable money is that it's programmable. Is it far-fetched? For now, probably, because there is a lack of alignment in what that behavior looks like across a variety of jurisdictions. Most money have been around for so long that we have somewhat an agreement upon what that technology looks like. But as with any new technology, it's going to go through the peak and the valley and the trough, and we're going to see some form of agreement in the medium long term to incorporate some of those characteristics, some of those utilities to this digital programmable form of money that will be considered the new standard. And don't get my quote, don't quote me on this, but if that wasn't the case, then why would so many central banks be pursuing things such as CBDCs, the central bank digital currencies, right? It's not just because there is an opportunity to use a technology, it's because there's an opportunity to add functionality to their sovereign money. And it's important. It's important for industries. It's important for governments. It's important to be able to capture those efficiencies horizontally where they have reach and influence.
Yeah, just to touch on this last comment regarding CBDC, I do feel comfortable with fiat currency, being able to hold it, being able to have it, and, you know, sometime in a not even feeling afraid of being deleted, if I would say, in the digital space. So this is something that I would not be comfortable, to be honest, when it comes to CBDC or central digital currency. I know that the FMI lady Lagardère, the French ex-minister of finance, was kind of pushing the agenda regarding CBDC, but still was like trying to protect people's privacy by saying this is not going to be imposed on you. You will still be able to use your own fiat currency or the CBDC, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, there's two different things that I'd like you to deep dive into CBDC and versus, let's say, the Ethereum network of Bitcoin.
Right. So I think there is a variety of angles in those discussions. And I usually approach the conversation about CBDC the same way that I approached creating my podcast is, what's the use case? What is this good for? Right? And there are different forms of CBDCs. So right now, there is an emerging pattern for the implementation of CBDCs that was by and large championed by the Central Bank of Brazil, which is you have a layer of a CBDC running between the banks and the central bank. That's called the wholesale CBDC or WCBDC. This is usually run on a permission blockchain. So it's not a public chain like Ethereum or Bitcoin. It's in Brazil, at least, they're using Bezu, which is an EVM compatible blockchain. So it's Ethereum-like, but it's permissioned. It operates nodes across the banks and the central bank. Then you have a second layer, which is the commercial bank layer, where they can issue CBDC-backed tokenized deposits. And then they choose what to use in terms of chains to issue those tokens. And this creates a separation between that permissioned, centrally owned blockchain doing the wholesale CBDC and a layer that could be a public chain on the tokenized deposits that then gets used by companies and individuals, preserving some of their privacy, or at least offering the same privacy that they would have on a public chain or a pseudonym. So there are patterns that can be applied to central bank digital currencies that serve themselves well for particular use cases. Do I think that CBDCs are going to replace fiat money or banknotes? I don't think so. Right now, I think that the latest measure is that the internet is available to 68% of the world's population. For a CBDC to be widespread as fiat, it would have to work offline. That isn't the case yet, although there's research coming out on what a offline CBDC will look like. That isn't trivial. And if it requires any form of hardware, then it isn't accessible to everybody. So we will see the persistence of fiat money in banknotes because the internet isn't ubiquitous, and fiat money needs to be, because that's how a functioning society works. So I think there are parameters to be pursued, and I don't think that CBDC is a one size fits all. It will require use cases. As any technology, it will require use cases for technology to be valuable. Now, I'm not a big fan of centrally issued, non-blockchain controlled retail CBDC. I think the temptation to do state surveillance is just too big when it comes to retail CBDCs. I prefer more of the two-layered approach that Brazil is doing. I think Hong Kong declared a similar approach last week. And if that pattern continues to evolve, I think that's probably going to be the winning pattern for central banks around the world.
But I struggle to see how they're different. So how is this two-layer CBDC structure less prone to state surveillance than just a straightforward retail CBDC?
Because it's one degree removed from being directly controlled by the central bank. You still have banking relationships. Your bank still knows everything you do in your account, but you're in a separate infrastructure and you're not touching directly the wholesale CBDC yourself. So there is a degree of separation It's not completely anonymous, but there is a degree of separation. The same way your bank knows how much you have withdrawn in bank notes from an ATM, they will know how much you moved from tokenized deposits to your pseudonymous wallet in the blockchain. It's the same concept.
If I may ask, because you have the background as a banker, banking background, okay, I've been listening to some of the guys on different podcasts mentioning that if we go back to regular banking system, there's two type of currency. Forget about the digital currency, just about the currency that banks are dealing with. So you have the currency that you and I can get access to it. And there is the interbank currency that you and me cannot get access to it. Are you talking about the same thing here, or is it something?
They operate in similar layers. Usually the interbanking, it's not that the money is different, but the actual system that they run between themselves is different than the ones that we access, settlement systems, something of that. So it's like the total of movement that I accrue during the day as a bank against you, I settle against you in gross. So it's large amounts. That's why it's wholesale. And then the relationship that I have with my own clients, then it's on the retail basis. So it's my systems running, it's as a bank, and you're consuming services that as a bank I offer you. So the architecture in terms of layers is pretty much, it's very similar. What changes is the underlying technology that now can be used with, you know, different flavors of blockchains to resolve each one of those layers to their different needs. But it's the same. It's like having the gross settlement between the banks and the central bank, and then another system that is between the bank and their own client base. But it's a similar layered architecture with different sets of technologies.
Yeah, that wouldn't make me comfortable still, because again, we have no access, as I was saying to some of friends, is like we don't have access to buy this currency that the bank are holding as well. And there were a lot of debate on the fact that
but maybe we don't want to, because that is under ultimate control of the central bank. And again, in terms of use cases, it only serves the purpose of netting interbank relationships. It has nothing to do with their clients. It has to do with the relationships between the two banks, or more. So they serve different purposes. That's why they're separated in terms of systems of different technologies serving those systems.
So I want to go back to what you said, which is only 68% of the world is connected digitally. So how do you see this play out with the growth of cryptocurrencies, the adoption of cryptocurrencies? Will this just simply widen this kind of technology gap? Is this going to be one of those things that those who adopt cryptocurrency will have such a huge edge because they either don't have access or don't understand it, to the point where it's going to change the world the way it looks like?
We'll be right back after the break.
Taka Talks brings you stories from around the world that will help you understand how crypto and Islamic finance can change our lives for the better. Subscribe and follow to keep learning.
Again,
I love your question. It's a great question. The way I see adoption moving forward with Web3, and I wrote extensively about it, and I still believe that those are the three pillars for widespread adoption, is education, which is already a gap in and of itself globally. So it is an edge. Regulatory integration. What I mean by that is that not everyone is going to be a DJ and self-sovereign and will own their own self-custody wallet, but they will want to have access to it. And for that, regulators play a big part. They play a big part not only in enabling a level playing field, but they play a big part by benefiting of the data that is now public and accessible to them in real time, which is very different than the current way that they access banking information from the traditional systems that are all enclosed and siloed. And the third thing is user experience. If you're in Web3 right now, being self-sovereign is very complicated. You almost need to become your own engineer to operate a wallet, be it hardware wallet, be it software wallet. You know, you have to understand swaps. You have to understand which chain your assets are. And there's a lot of complication in moving assets from one chain to another. So the UX isn't there yet. So if we can resolve education, meaning not only financial literacy, but digital literacy and then crypto literacy. And if we can get the regulators to not only declare what rules are there, but also participate on the blockchain by accessing the data, maybe even offering smart contract patterns for regulated forms of financial instruments or other industries to play within the realms of regulation, even though they are in a public infrastructure. And if we can get a better UX, seamless, more intuitive, less risky experience, more secure, I think we have a better shot at reaching closer to those 68%. Do I think that crypto is going to push for more internet adoption just because crypto is what it is? That is a very hard no, because we've had 30 years of internet, of commercial internet, and we're still at 68%. So it's not a function of how monetized the internet is, it's a function of how we can actually make digital inclusion something real for those who aren't yet digital. So I think that there is a gap there that crypto cannot fulfill, but if we can get close to the 68% that the internet covers, it will be a major industry, no question about it.
Wouldn't that greatly, greatly disadvantage people who are already disadvantaged by, you know, not being online? And you know, it goes just totally against the whole idea of Web3 being inclusive, you know, supposed to encourage financial inclusion. But it feels to me like this is just going to widen the gap between the haves and the have-nots. Because then now, you know, with the crypto summer, essentially those who are in crypto or getting richer are just experiencing this incredible deflation, inflation and depreciation of their currency. That's just going to make that gap wider.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's our reality. Right. I mean, crypto cannot exist outside of the internet and crypto cannot implement the internet. But there is a recent, maybe not recent, but the name became something of interest recently that might play a part in crypto helping out, not doing it by itself, excuse me, but helping out spread physical infrastructure to enable, as you said, more inclusion. There is this new form of, or this new business model called DPIN. I'm not sure if you guys have come across this. DPIN is the crypto acronym for Decentralized Physical Networks. And DPIN is basically a incentive architecture for people to implement or hardware or install software that creates a physical infrastructure for other people's to consume. So I'll give you one example that's probably one of the OG, the most, or the earliest example is Helium. Helium, what they do is that they pay you in Helium tokens and you install a hotspot of the Helium network on your house. And it creates a hotspot that anyone who pays in Helium tokens can use to access the internet. So it's an actual physical device that has a token incentive model between suppliers and consumers, the access of Wi-Fi into regions. As it stands right now, it's popular in the US. In Mexico, they partnered with Telefonica, the large telco operator, to actually help Telefonica reach wider regions at a better price point using the Helium network. So while I don't think that this is going to solve everyone's problem and bring everybody onto the internet, because we have incentive mechanisms built into this physical infrastructure, more people might be willing to put their space at quote-unquote rent to get some rewards while providing a service to other people. So I think there are models to expand and to become more inclusive. I just don't think that it depends only on crypto.
Got it. At least there is some effort to that extent. So you touched a little bit about regulatory integration. Those were your words. As part of the three pillars of adoption. Now, my experience, though, with the regulatory side of things is that especially in developing countries, they're extremely jealous about their money, right? About money in general. It's like they want to control it. And just in the last couple of days in Nigeria, they actually arrested some Binance executives. So they told them, come, we need to talk about something. And they arrested them. They've been put away for like, I think, 2 weeks now. And the official explanation, or at least what people on the internet are saying, is because the Nigerian government feels like Binance is a core contributor to the devaluation of them. So how do we reconcile like this, you know, the whole Bitcoin movement and the whole crypto movement came to actually decouple from the regulatory structure because they were not doing us any favors. Central banks were actually gambling with people's money from 2008 financial crisis. And yet the need for them at this juncture to promote adoption.
So I think that it will require a change of stance. It will require regulators to understand that this is not just a technological advancement and not even a revolution. This is a change in paradigm. And one thing I learned in my years in crypto is that words really matter. So right now, central banks, the usual financial services regulator, emphasis on central, are being faced with a technology that runs in a decentralized fashion that is not centrally owned and therefore doesn't have an owner and it doesn't have the central point of failure. So that poses to them to face their own reality. And as regulators, they cannot move fast. There are whole industries that rely on them and that have relied on them for many, many years. And those industries might be disrupted here and there, but they can't break because they break local economies and international relationships. So the balance between moving fast to understand the new paradigm does not match the pace in which they can move fast to accommodate the new paradigm. And even though I worked for 20 plus years in financial services, and I've been in crypto for 10, my experience with regulators is that they're all smart people. And they have to be overzealous because there are whole economies that depend on them. So I think what we're seeing is the CBDC exercises are a way of central banks to experiment within control what it looks like to play with the decentralized paradigm. Is it enough? Probably not. Is it a step in the right direction? I hope so. But I think more importantly, as the generations of regulators evolve, we're going to see more tech-savvy regulators that will be willing to do more closer to the transactional infrastructure that they now face than the current generation. And those are the regulators that might come into play in doing what I call the regulatory integration. Hopefully, they understand by now, as they come as the newly minted regulator, they understand that money is a technology. And that technology can be decentralized and that they can actually benefit from adopting some of that technology and understanding that new paradigm to their own benefit. And my guess is the regulator that does it first will get a lot of advantage in attracting builders, investment, talent, and ultimately prosperity to the jurisdictions where they rule. So there is an incentive for them to also experiment, try, adopt, and adapt.
Yeah, I'm thinking that those regulations are going to come from the developing world as well. Just because when you look at the the developed world, the leader of the free world, you have how old is he now? Like 78-year-old versus a 76-year-old presidential candidate. So I don't see leadership coming from those rapidly aging populations.
Yeah, good point on that. Actually, when the last bull market, we saw country like Singapore being very in forefront of this technology. And because of the bust of some of the top, has really scared the regulator from Singapore trying to take the lead into that space, actually. And I don't think they still recover from this painful crash. And as Sharon mentioned, adoption, of course, will come definitely from less developed nation. We see a lot of things happening, like you see in Brazil, for example. Emerging nation who are more like into, hey, we need to do something. This is the future. And they might be also surprising us. El Salvador is one of them too. So, and then we might even be surprised with some African nation taking the lead into adopting not only the technology, but also the regulatory framework that could also put them back on the map. I think there's too much mess happening in the US now in terms of finding what is right. And they, like you said, there's too many smart people involved, and that maybe take too much time to really make it happen. So I'm still present. Then we see, of course, Dubai emerging again as a nation where, this technology is welcome. Like we have now, I think 600 Web3 company that just register as the last updates. So it's kind of phenomenal. But yet, it's a race to technology. And then we see the emergence of AI as well, which is like a race again, that every nation want to own some of this technology to leapfrog the advance versus the other one.
Yeah, my usual three examples of regulators that I see, or better, jurisdictions that I see moving towards, that regulatory integration I talked about. Brazil is number one, not because I'm Brazilian, but it's because the way that they've tackled the challenge is very much what you would expect from a progressive regulator. So that's one. Second one is Singapore, as you said. It is a privilege for a country of that size having someone like Supnendo Mohanty at the helm, right? He's a current chief fintech officer in Singapore, and most of the things that they've done there has had their hands on it, and it's an amazing individual. And more recently, there were two bills that they are tangential to digital assets, but they are very important to widespread adoption. One is the Financial Services and Markets Bill that deal with trading and registration. And the second one is the Electronic Trade Documents Bill that deal with the use of blockchain in the context of trade finance, prebual lading and other varied documents. So I think there are examples. Are they concerted examples? Are they comprehensive, exhaustive examples? No, the reality is much more complex than that. But there are other smaller examples. Wyoming, the state in the U.S., last week approved a new law that recognizes DAOs as a specific type of legal construct, which is a victory for DAOs in the world. Wyoming is also working on a state-sponsored stablecoin, which is also incredible to hear about. So I think there are examples. They're not evenly distributed. But one thing we agree, I think adoption, because of the need, will come from the Global South. I think the Global South found in crypto mechanisms to leapfrog their current state of affairs and become much more digital. So in the Global South, where there is internet, because crypto depends on it, I think we will see an uptake in crypto leading from that space. There is one story I heard Santiago C from Proof of Humanity. He's an Argentinian guy, and he took Vitalik Buterin, founder of Ethereum, to Argentina a couple years ago, and he was shocked that the maids, the waiters, the taxi drivers, the people like selling stuff on the street, they all knew who Vitalik was because they all use crypto. They use stablecoins. They use Bitcoin. They use Ethereum. They use Tether. They use, you know, all their blockchains. It's commonplace. And the reason why they do is because they're all trying to fight inflation in the means that they have. And blockchains are permissionless, so anyone can actually go and try them. And if it works for them, then it solves the problem that nobody else is solving. That's why we use technology. So do I think it's going to come massively from the global south? Yes. And I think if any country in the global south nails the combination of education, UX, and regulatory integration, we have a good chance of seeing that kind of become the standard of that particular jurisdiction, because the benefits are tangible.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to pivot just to this last part of the podcast, and I would like you to tell us actually what Midnight does.
So Midnight, currently in its form, is a DevNet blockchain, so it's open for developers. Midnight currently does, you can actually program data-protected applications, so you can actually move data around the blockchain without having to disclose the data. The way that works is that you build an application, that application runs on the blockchain, and by the time it touches the data that's on your computer, it wraps that data into a zero-knowledge proof, and the proof gets written on the blockchain in the context of the business rule for that particular application. So even if you crack, which you will not, the cryptography for the proof, the information there is not the data. It's just the information about the data that never leaves your device. So this is what we're currently offering and testing. And there's plenty of builders on our Discord channel asking questions, giving suggestions. We have an internal roadmap for the mainnet launch down the line. And we want to learn as much as possible so we can just build the best product for builders we can. So this is where we are right now. We have big ambitions for Midnight. It is a partner chain to Cardano, so we want to make sure that we are well integrated in the community and obviously creating a lot of value for the people who, you know, preceded us. And we're so excited to be building this. Charles Hoskins, the founder of IO and our founder, says that this is the fourth generation blockchain. So it is super exciting and obviously a privilege to be working in the fourth generation blockchain.
That's amazing. But, you know, it's actually really technical. So make it easy for us to understand by telling us what are the use cases for this kind of technology.
Sure, use cases. Yeah. So the classic use case is you go to a casino and you want to bet. And the agent on the table will ask to see. And when you give your ID, there is a photo of you, there's your name, there's your date of birth, there's maybe your address, maybe the number of your driver's license or any other form of official identification. But the only thing that they actually need is to know whether you're above 18 or 21, depending on the state. But in the meantime, you gave away all of that data. So Midnight supports use cases where instead of having to give away all of that data, the only thing that the business process will ask is Mauricio above 21? And the proof that wrapped my date of birth is going to just say yes or no, because that's all they need to know. So in an extreme example, you could run a whole business without having to hold on to any data, just by asking the right questions about the data in form of zero knowledge proofs. Obviously, this is an ultimate example, but it's the amount of data that we hold as businesses today, and that creates what we call the honeypots. And it becomes interesting for hackers to come and try to steal the data that you have responsibilities to. And obviously, with the increasing amount of data protection regulation across the world since the introduction of the GDPR in Europe back in 2018, more and more countries are introducing data protection regulation that are very punitive to businesses of all kinds. So having zero knowledge to build on a decentralized infrastructure that's still public, like any other blockchain, it is a very interesting device for businesses that are trying to capture benefits from using public chains like programmable money, but they haven't yet because in public blockchains, all their data would be public. So with Midnight, you can actually do what we call the best of both worlds. You have a public chain, but you also have the ability to protect the data when a regulation or even your business needs demand. So it is a better way to handle your business on chain than traditionally you would have.
And question also, why Cardano?
What do you mean, why Cardano? There's a whole page that Charles wrote many years ago.
Yeah. But why did you choose Cardano versus other layer? Like Ethereum, for example.
Cardano is the main chain of Midnight, right? Midnight is a partner chain to Cardano. So the way that IO, Input Output, which is the company where I work, IO is one of the builders of Cardano. So Midnight being also part of the IO portfolio, is one way for Cardano to expand and grow the ecosystem with a different offering. So the way the partner chains work is that we inherit some characteristics from the main chain, Cardano, to run the blockchain that is a partner chain. That's why we're spinning Midnight out of Cardano, essentially, in terms of, you know, depending on the Cardano security. So it's an intrinsic relationship. More than anything else. It's not that we chose Cardano, it's that Cardano is giving birth to Midnight.
Very cool. Thank you. So to wrap up, I'm asking you to share something humorous or unexpected, a story that's humorous or unexpected from your experiences in the crypto and blockchain industry and discovery.
Wow. I think that what obviously the technology is what interested me first in the industry. But what keeps me in the industry is the people. In this industry, I found the most brilliant, caring, loving friends that I've ever come across in a professional scenario. And I think I've been helped by more people than I've ever helped. And I want to stay here and continue to pay it forward. So I don't know how curious this is, but I usually say that Web3 is for the people, and I truly believe that. And I hope I know that we have, you know, the bad apples, as any industry does, but I also hope that we're fast to identify and weed them out as much as we can, so we only keep the best of the breed. So yeah, we have an incredible industry with incredible people, and I hope I can be around long enough to pay it forward.
Fantastic. Great way to end the podcast. Maurizio, if people want to reach out to you, to talk to you, how can they do so and where can they find your podcast?
I'm most active on LinkedIn. You can find me, Maurizio Magaldi. So it's easy. Let me know where you found me from so I can accept your invite. Otherwise, I'm going to ignore you because I don't know who you are. I'm also on Twitter on Xerox Maurizio, and you can follow Block Drops podcast in on Spotify, any major streaming platform. I do have a newsletter on LinkedIn where you can keep tabs on Block Drops as well, so feel free to subscribe. And you can learn more about Midnight at midnight.network, and you can actually access the DevNet by following the instructions on docs.midnight.network. That's doc.midnight.network. And we would be glad to have you over and building a Midnight, trying to break Midnight, help us build a better product for all of you. So thank you so much for having me. I love the conversation. I hope I didn't create more confusion in people's minds. But yeah, such a pleasure. Appreciate you guys having me over.
Thank you so much, Maurizio. Likewise.
Taka Talks. Stories of financial systems, crypto, and the Islamic economy.